Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture on private defense for the Mises Academy class, Anarcho-Capitalism. This is August 15th, 2012. And as I say, tonight we're talking about private defense. So we've got a lot of interesting issues to go over. Before I jump into the details, let me just say that this is an area where I think even many defenders of anarcho-capitalism are a bit off, that they think that, anarcho-capitalism would work great in providing roads and apples and software and books and so forth and music, but when it comes to military defense, that's something where the government, the state really has an edge. And I remember I even catered to that when I was given a talk. Some of you guys may know Jason Osborne. He's somebody who is associated with the Free State Project. And his dad is into this stuff, I guess, because Jason got into it. And his dad had me go and give a talk to his local, it was like a Rotary Club or something like that. So, I mean, it was like old school guys who were into civic duty and stuff like that. So they're real conservative, but they certainly weren't anarchist. And I came in and I gave a talk that was very anti-government in the sense that I was talking about how voluntary institutions could do all these kind of things. And I didn't touch, obviously, privatizing the court system and the police and the military, because that would have been crazy talking to a bunch of guys, some of whom were actual military veterans and stuff. That just would have been, there would have been no upside to that. And so in the Q&A, one of the guys said to me something like, is there anything you think the government does good? Or maybe he said does well. I don't want to make it sound like a Neanderthal. And so with this group of 60 old guys looking at me and being a little skeptical, I punted and I just said something like, yeah, taking our money and blowing stuff up. And I got a chuckle and just moved on to the next question. All right, so, I don't regret having said that. I mean, I don't know what else. I certainly wasn't going to go into his spiel on anarcho-capitalism on the spot with this group of guys who, for all I knew, were in Korea or something. But the point is, I think there is this sense among even actual anarcho-capitalists that, say what you will about the government or the state, but they're trained killers and they're really good at war making. And I actually don't think that's true. I think they're horrible at war making in the sense of, if you're in charge of this apparatus and you want to get something done and you're going to use violence to do it, that all of the things that are problematic about achieving any other objective using a monopoly institution, that also applies to the goal of repelling a foreign invader, or even if you want to go conquer another country. Okay, so it's now for something like if your goal is to set up a police state and have a new world order so you and your banker friends can be in charge of the world, well, it's a little bit weird, I guess, to say using the state and the central bank and so forth is a poor way of doing that. Because you can't, almost by definition, you can't rely on the free market to do that. So obviously in certain situations what I'm saying doesn't make sense, but I'm saying generally speaking, all of the things that make the government seem incompetent or just waste a lot of money for what it gets out of the results and so forth, all those things actually apply more so to military operations than they do to other ones. And when we get to that part in the lecture, I hope I remember to explain that particular point again, but I just want to say it up front. So let me put it this way. I wasn't just bluffing for rhetorical effect in chaos theory on this essay when I was speaking so proudly about the abilities of a free society to defend itself. I really do believe if there were a small group, let's say, some little group of 500,000 anarcho-capitalists that had modern property rights and technology and had a level of capital per worker comparable to the United States, I think they would easily repel the entire United States military. I mean, I suppose if the U.S. launched a bunch of ICBMs at them and just kept firing so that a few got through and just blew them up, okay, maybe they could wipe them out, but they wouldn't be able to conquer them. That's what I'm saying, that another state would not be able to conquer a well-functioning, rich anarcho-capitalist community that had at least 500,000 people. And of course, I'm just pulling these numbers out of thin air, but that's what I believe. And so in today's lecture, I'm going to try to get you to see why I think that. Maybe you're going to think I'm nuts, but I want you to at least see the argument, because it's not nearly as obvious as, even like I say, many believers in freedom think. And so one more example of the kind of mentality I'm talking about. I think there's a lot of people who think that our society would be great and it would work, except we would get taken over, you know, and that's kind of their, and many of them are wistful and say, hey, throw caution to the wind, let's go ahead and do it, and maybe we'll have 20 years of freedom before we get conquered by somebody else, but at least, you know, better to have lived free and been conquered than to never have lived free at all. That's kind of their mentality. So, and like I say, I think that's totally wrong. That other things equal, again, it's the point in chaos theory where I talk about comparing apples to apples. Other things equal, a group of people can defend itself better if they rely on voluntary means for provision of defense services. So yes, Nazi Germany is going to be able to take over a group of 1,000 anarchists unless they have Martian technology or something. But by the same token, Nazi Germany is going to steamroller over 1,000 statists, relying on, you know, the 999 serve their dictator and he gives them orders. Those people are really going to get crushed. At least if they're all anarchists, they might have a shot. Okay, so that's the mentality I want you to see. So if you can understand how being decentralized and having innovation and having everybody being able to contribute to the defense, like if one guy has an idea that's really good, it's more likely that that thing is going to get copied and multiplied and propagated through the society and quickly adopted if you're in a free anarchist environment. Whereas if you're in a top-down military hierarchy, the top guys need to have a good idea. If some grunt on the front lines has a brilliant idea, it's probably not going to make it all the way up the chain of command and then get conferred upon and then get communicated down, or certainly it's going to take a long time for that to happen. All right, so that's where I'm coming from. So let me just try to get you guys to see that. Like I said in the beginning of this class, for me, the hard question is private law. Private defense to me is a piece of cake. That's not an issue at all. Okay, so this first slide, domestic defense, is it distinct from so-called foreign defense? And so this was something that back in the, when I was doing stomping ground days of grad school on the this website, antistate.com. Now, I haven't even been to this thing, this website, literally in years. So I don't even know if it's still a cool place to go or not. But back in the day, this is where all the cool young anarcho-capitalists hung out. We used to debate all this stuff. And this was a question somebody posed to me right when chaos theory first came out. Because, again, for those of you who don't know, I wrote that when I was in grad school. And somebody said to me, and it kind of caught me off guard, someone said, you know, Bob, why do you have this bifurcated view? It's like in part one of your little pamphlet, you're talking about how there could be an insurance system and legal system and contractual agreements, blah, 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 and private police forces and detective agencies and all this stuff and private prisons and all these things. They're like hotels, great. And then you have a whole other chapter. It's like you do Control-Alt-Delete, and all of a sudden now you're talking about this completely separate apparatus whose function it is to repel Chinese tanks and aircraft, long-range bombers and things. And so he said, why is that? It would seem to me, this person said, that the same mechanisms, institutional mechanisms that would arise in a market to deal with a local crime boss or a serial killer or a rapist would be the same structures that would evolve and arise spontaneously in a market setting to repel a bunch of serial killers who are all taking orders from some foreign dictator, because that's what an army is. All right, so that was the guy's question. So he was asking me, you know, why do you seem to have, in other words, he thought I was buying into the problem. This happens a lot when libertarians think about privatizing government functions, is a lot of times we assume that the market solution is going to be basically like the government approach, except there'll be shareholders instead of politicians. And where, you know, whereas in reality, a lot of times, no, that's totally wrong. That what would happen if you actually got the government out of the way and let the free market solve an issue is there would be totally different approaches, and the government solution is actually very dim-witted and so forth and short-sighted. So that's kind of what he was saying to me there, that why are you assuming that because the government has this distinct Department of Defense and then these local police services and so on, why do you think that's how the free market would approach it? So on the one hand, I mean, that's certainly true, and it always is possible that the market's provisions for certain types of services or things that consumers want would be so far removed, and we just have no idea how to imagine it. And certainly, the further in the future we go, the less able I or anybody else would be to predict even the pattern of what the market response would look like. So there's always that caveat whenever we talk about this kind of stuff, is we don't know. And that's part of the argument for privatizing this stuff and opening it up to competition, is who knows what the right way to deal with an enemy invasion is. Let's open it up to competition and entrepreneurs and let the best idea win, or the best ideas win. Having said all that, I still think it makes sense to treat these things as distinct. Partly because there's a qualitative difference. In social ostracism. Okay, so I don't know if I actually use that term in the lecture in weeks 1 and 2 for this course, but that's, and I'm sure many of you picked up on this, that's sort of underlying my vision for how society could contain individuals who are part of the society but are sort of stepping out of line. That there'll be all sorts of automatic things that, boom, just hit, like, okay, now all of a sudden your landlord changes the locks on your door and you can't get back into your apartment, because you have this outstanding judgment against you saying that you just robbed a bank, and you're not dealing with that. You're just walking around town ignoring the fact that this judge, this reputable judge, just ruled against you saying that, yeah, the bank brought charges against you, said you robbed them last week at gunpoint, and I agree with them. So I think that you owe the bank 50,000 ounces of gold plus 10,000 ounces of retribution for their court costs and blah, blah, blah. So pay it up, or else right now you're an outlaw. And you're just like, oh, forget that. I don't care what you think. You're not the boss of me. And you're just walking around. Well, there'd be all sorts of things that would kick in that I think, depending on the circumstances and the scenario we're talking about, but if it's a major metropolitan area, I think all the supermarkets would have the ability to know that you were an outlaw and wouldn't let you in. You certainly couldn't rent a car. You certainly couldn't rent an apartment. And if you already had an apartment, I think there'd be clauses built in that now they would just kick you out. Or even if you had a house and you owned the land on it and there were no covenant agreements from when you first moved in, handling this sort of situation, well, at the very least, the power company would stop sending you electricity, and you'd lose your broadband. I mean, like I said last week, if you didn't have your broadband, what's the point of living? So I think that's the way they could quickly bring somebody to heel, and you wouldn't need to have this massive FBI and these tons of police officers and things and these giant prison apparatus. I don't think that would even be necessary, because I think most people would quickly be brought back into line with these other incentives, just because the benefits of being part of society would be so enormous that you would have to be psychotic to consciously reject that. So, but that stuff doesn't really work if you're talking about a bunch of conscripts who are coming from another country, you know, their own government points guns at them and makes them get on a ship and then sends them across the ocean. I mean, yeah, it's true. Once they got over here and tried to take over, after perhaps a few years of occupation, they would gradually sort of bleed into your own culture and you'd sort of absorb them. And I'm not even being flippant. I really do think that's true, that a free society would be so vibrant and just superior in so many respects to a statist society that if the statists sent their people over to try to conquer you, even if they did achieve a short-term military victory and the free people just said, okay, it's not worth fighting these guys, we're just going to have our kids get slaughtered, it's not worth it, we'll go ahead and start paying taxes to them or whatever. But still, the fact that they really had been a free anarcho-capitalist society with the technology and so forth of the first world right now, that even with this foreign occupation army in there, they would just quickly start finding loopholes and just would, I think, just outgrow them and absorb them. Like, ideologically, eventually, that the occupiers would say, these people, I'd rather live here, and they would defect. And then, like, the foreign commanders would have to come up with ways to make sure their troops didn't just abandon their posts and just sneak into the night. And I mean, just to give you an idea of what I mean, it would be like, so imagine, let's just give you a specific example. So say we're talking about the current United States turns anarcho-capitalist next Friday, and for some reason they can't have like an official military with actual hardware, with tanks and surface-to-air missiles and things like that, for some reason. It's just like guys with their hunting rifles is all they got, for whatever reason. Who knows why? I'm saying, let's say China says, aha, these idiots, they've foregone the benefits of having a state monopoly, and so quick, let's load up the aircraft carriers and the troop deploy, the troop carriers and all that stuff, and they send over an army of a million conscripts and a bunch of tanks and so forth, and they come up and they land in whatever, North Carolina. What would happen? So it's true. It might be the case that literally seeing, I mean, they would probably put some mines in the water and whatever, and maybe fire off some cannons at them or whatever, you know, have some shoulder missiles and so forth that they could get on eBay. But for the sake of argument, assume there's no huge military presence. Like, maybe the anarchists are so worried about a standing army that they say, no. Yeah, we read this guy Murphy's book, we read Rothbard, we read Han Papa, and we know how we could have a huge military that would just flick these guys back towards China like they're brushing off some gnats, but then we're worried that those guns would be turned on us. We don't want to have another state, and so maybe these people are so hardcore and so skeptical of just authority in general that they don't even, they won't pay a dime to any institution that would like fund a tank. Okay, that's possible. And actually, that might be wise if they thought like that. So let's say that happened. So the Chinese aircraft carriers and whatever come over, they start sending over bombers, and they just blowing the crap out of wherever they think there's any possible resistance. Just shock and awe, like what the United States does when it goes into the Middle East right now and takes over a country. And so all the population realizes, yeah, we could sit here from the trees and take pot shots and maybe take out 100,000 of these guys, but there's still going to be 900,000 of them, and then they're going to be mad, and they're going to, like, rape our wives and daughters and kill all of our sons, and what's the point of that? Forget it. That's not worth it, okay? So I'm trying to be realistic here. Let's say that happens. Okay. I'm claiming within a few years that occupation army would dissolve, no matter what the Chinese communist leadership did back in mainland China, because think about it. These guys, they're like 18-year-old kids who, I mean, for one thing, if we're talking about China, like, the male-female ratio is all screwed up. So, you know, I won't go down that train of thought, but in an anarchist society, let your imagination run wild. So that's one temptation right there for why they might abandon their post and go hang out with the anarchists. But beyond that, this standard of living in this place that they just conquered, I mean, it would be like they just landed in the Wizard of Oz or something. I mean, they would just, the wealth, because it wouldn't just be like the United States right now. Remember, there's no taxes, there's no regulations, there's no silly regulations. You know, the only regulations are ones that are in place for insurance companies and consumer groups and things like that that make sense. I mean, this place would be fantastically wealthy. So if they just, you know, and the other people on the other side, they would be broadcasting and slipping them propaganda. You know, like the guys who were patrolling at night and walking around to make sure that they didn't see anyone walking around with guns on them or anything, because there's like a, you know, they disarmed the population, that sort of thing. People would go up to them and be like, hey, check it out, and like would give them a pamphlet that would say, you know, I run a factory 2 kilometers away, Chinese welcome, no questions asked, just, you know, you can't be armed, but you can come over. I don't care if you used to be in the military. We understand it wasn't your decision. If you show up and you're unarmed and you have a good attitude and are willing to work, I will pay you more in the first 2 weeks than your family can earn in a year back in China, just working in my factory, because your productivity is so much higher here than it is back home. And we have sophisticated ways of wiring them money. We have all kinds of dissident groups over in China right now who can funnel money to them. So, you know, why don't you just defect? And within a few weeks, your family back home can have more money than they would have been able to earn in 5 years. All right. So I'm saying it would be hard for the Chinese commanders to keep their troops from just disappearing into the night. They'd have to do stuff like rotate, like, you know, they'd have to have standing orders saying, if you defect, we're going to throw your family in jail back home. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to get you guys to see here, is the free society that we're talking about, if it really works the way we think, we don't need to worry about getting conquered by some foreign state. Okay, so, but the point of me going through all that was to say, even so, there is a qualitative difference, that it would take a while for these institutions to sort of absorb this enemy force. It does seem to me that probably, unless, like I say, the domestic population had such an aversion to a standing army that they didn't even want there to be tanks on their soil at all, because they were just afraid that somehow they'd fall into the wrong hands, that I think institutionally it would make sense for them to, they would have a qualitatively different type of response, so that if there's enemy carrier groups coming across the ocean, they deal with that in a way that's distinct from how they deal with a few serial killers. I mean, those are different types of threats, so it seems to me, why wouldn't you have a different type of approach to dealing with them? Okay, yeah, I don't know why there's a double slide here. Hopefully that was just, that wasn't replacing something else. Okay, another point, law enforcers, not promulgators. So this is a theme that I keep stressing in this course, this idea. And again, what I'm trying to get you to see with this is that there is this tendency in the standard anarcho-capitalist literature that makes it sound like these would all be vertically integrated functions, that the same firm would have some employees that would make a decision as to say, okay, in this conflict, who's in the right, who's in the wrong, and then this other division within the same company, okay, boys, go get them. And I don't think that, I mean, conceptually, there's no reason that would be the truth or that would be the case. And then even in practice, I don't predict that would happen. Just like, so for me, I mean, it's a bit silly, but that's why I picked this picture. I didn't merely pick this picture just, you know, to be funny, to have something up here to catch your eye so you don't doze off while I'm giving this lecture. I actually think that is the best way to think about what the police would be like in a free society. Right? So I could have put up a picture of actual police officers now, but I think that would have been misleading. Because the point is, right now, nobody is afraid of a mall cop. No one's afraid of mall security. You're not worried that if you swear at the guy, he's going to beat the crap out of you, right? If you're driving around looking for a parking spot in the mall, and a mall security vehicle drives by, you don't freeze up and say, "Oh my gosh, is everyone's seatbelt on? Oh my gosh, does anyone have pot on them?" Whereas if you're in high school with your buddy or something, and one of them has his hat on backwards, and an actual police officer rolls by, you do panic, and you're like, "Oh my gosh, who's in the car with me? Is my tail light out?" And you're panicked that he's going to pull you over and mess with you and ruin your month. Okay, so I'm saying that would not happen in a free society. The police officers, or I don't even know what they would call them, people would not be afraid of them. Because if they were, that firm would go out of business. That there'd be competition, and if some particular individual or some group that worked for a particular company, if there were even just one incident where there was shoplifting and they chased a guy down and broke his leg, and there were a bunch of onlookers that said, you know, they really didn't have to do that. That he wasn't going to make it to the end. You know, they had their own guys blocking the entrance. He wasn't armed. And they could have just, you know, they didn't need to tackle him. They could have just surrounded him, and then he would have had to give up. And they didn't need to tackle him and do that. They clearly just had a bunch of testosterone going, and they wanted to teach that punk a lesson. Well, then that firm's in big trouble, because then they figure out, okay, who hired them? And, you know, if it's the mall that was hiring the general security for the mall itself, they would have had to make an apology. You know, they would have a press conference or whatever, and they would have been real obsequious. But the fundamental difference is, unlike when the mayor gets in front of the thing after there's a case of police brutality and says, "Oh my gosh, this is unacceptable. My administration will do everything we can to root out brutality," nothing happens to him. It's not like the next election is going to turn on whether he actually does something about the fact that, you know, this teenager just got beaten up on TV. Nobody cares. Not that nobody cares, but no one can do anything about it. Whereas if it's a particular mall and you could take your business elsewhere, and especially if the cops were, you know, especially if it were like white mall security officers that were unnecessarily physical with like a black teenager, well, there would be a noticeable drop in the number of black patrons going to that mall. They'd go somewhere else. Right? So that mall owner would instantly get feedback and realize the true cost of that incident. Whereas, like I say, the mayor of a big city, his electoral success really isn't on the margin affected one way or the other. I mean, if there's just rampant systematic abuse and the voters actually think the next guy, his challenger, will do something about it, maybe that will have an influence and actually hurt him. But notice all those confluence of events that need to be the case there. If the voters think either candidate is going to be awful and is catering to the law and order, because very few people are going to run for mayor in a city and say, "I'm going to be soft on crime." No one is going to win an election saying that. Now, they might be more nuanced and say, "We're very concerned about civil liberties and we want to make sure that there's no brutality, but we're going to, you know, drop the hammer on actual lawbreaker." Someone might try to thread the needle like that. But even there, even when I was just talking, trying to be this hypothetical guy, if the phrase came out of your mouth, "We're concerned about civil liberties and you're running for mayor," I'd be surprised if you could win an election in the United States saying that. That's not something that office holders typically say. Okay, so anyway, that's, like I say, I picked this particular image quite consciously. I don't think that what we would call police, what we would think of as police, I don't know what they would call them, would be intimidating at all, because their function would not be to be this like real intimidating force that goes around and punishes people. That's not really the way I think that it would happen. Okay, so I had focused a lot on this point, so I'm not going to dwell on it more. So next slide, I already anticipated some of what I was going to say I said it on the last slide, but here let me just focus on this issue of police immunity. So this is a point that Rothbard really stresses in his treatment of this stuff, and it's just a pretty common notion that just because you have a badge, just because you're part of the police, doesn't mean for some reason the law doesn't apply to you. And so Rothbard has a good treatment of this. So for example, like with an interrogation, so I haven't read the passage lately, but my recollection is that Rothbard handles it something like this. He's saying, let's say the police have someone in their custody and they think that he's a criminal, and they think that, like, let's say he has evidence and he knows that how to unravel some other crime. Like, here I'm putting words in his mouth. I'm trying to give you guys a vivid example just to make this a concrete thing that we can all know what we're talking about. Let's take the hypothetical popular case of the authorities have someone in the room, you know, in the cell, and they think he was part of a terrorist plot, and there's a bomb right now that's like in Grand Central Station, but they can't find it, and it's going to go off and kill 1,000 people, and he knows where it is. And so the question is, what can you do to that guy to get that information out of him? And I think Rothbard's general view is, it's okay if you're the police in a libertarian society, if you want to get physical with the guy, go right ahead. But if it turns out you're wrong and he really doesn't have anything to do with it, then the weight of the law falls on the interrogators, just as if they grabbed any old person off the street and started pulling out his fingernails or whatever they do to the guy, give him electrical shocks, waterboard him, what have you. Right? So the point is, you don't get a special pass just because, hey, give me a break, this is what my line of work is, I need to have exemptions, because otherwise, why would anybody go into law enforcement if we thought there was a chance that during the normal operation of our duties, we might get in trouble and have to go to jail for 10 years because we tortured a guy erroneously. You know, that's not our fault, we made an honest mistake. You're telling me now? So that's what the general public thinks. They think there need to be this thing called police immunity, because otherwise the police couldn't do their jobs. And Rothbard rejects that. So let's just take that a little bit further. I think it's not a black or a white issue. In other words, I think there are valid concerns on both sides there, that Rothbard is correct, that you can't, I mean, first of all, just something about that notion that there's different laws that apply to people, that literally violates what we think we have here in a free society, is equal protection under the law, and that everybody's equal in the eyes of the law. That's what we're taught we're supposed to have in this country, and yet in the same breath, people will then come around and say, oh yeah, but the police, of course, if they go on a drug raid and break into somebody's house and shoot the guy, the police aren't going to be treated the same way as some just gang that breaks into a guy's house and shoots him, because the police, they're the police. So Rothbard's point is, it's odd if you're talking about how you need a rule of law, and that's why you're not an anarchist, because you think that the government has to enforce these rules so we can have a nation of laws and not of profit and loss signals, that you also think there should be basically two sets of laws, one for the government officials and one for everybody else. So that's odd. But then beyond that, Rothbard says just the incentives. If the police know there really are no consequences for them interrogating somebody who turns out to be innocent, or breaking into the wrong house and shooting it up and killing a guy because they just weren't very careful, or because they naively followed a tip. You know, somebody called them up and said, "Hey, that guy you're looking for, he's down the street in apartment 3B." And it turned out that either that person was just wrong, or that person had a vendetta against the guy in 3B and thought, "Hey, this will be a fun trick. I'll get the police to go storm that guy's apartment and shoot him up." Okay, so the point is these accidents that the police have, or that the FBI or the CIA or whoever have, when they lock people up and interrogate them, especially if we're talking about the war on terror, that even if you stipulate that it makes sense for the government to be waging a war on terror, the way it conducts that war depends on the incentives. And clearly, if the people who are in – let me put it this way. If you are the government and you know if a bomb goes off and blows up a bridge and you're the head of the anti-terrorism unit, people are going to be mad at you, right? They're going to say, you should have done more. What the heck is your deal? Your budget is $2 billion a year. You've got 3,000 employees, blah, 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 all these spy satellites, and you couldn't stop a bomb from going off in San Francisco. What the heck is your problem? You might lose your job. So you're going to have the incentive to err on the side of following up every lead. And if you have somebody in custody that might be a terrorist, why would you let the guy out if there are no penalties for imprisoning the wrong people? If there's no penalty for waterboarding someone who turns out to be innocent, why wouldn't you err on the side of waterboarding people? Because maybe you do have the mastermind in your custody, even though you're not sure. Let's waterboard him and see what he knows. And worst case, you guess he was innocent. Okay, put him back on a plane, see you later. You see the point? So there's that issue as well. So so what I'm saying is, so there's clearly, there's a lot to be said for that type of argument that Rothbard and people like him would put up. But I want to say we can certainly even incorporate the concerns of the law and order types. All right, so somebody who says, oh my gosh, you guys are being so naive, there really are cases, or there could be, you can't just dismiss them as impossible. What if in your cute little anarchist world, what if there really is somebody like the Joker from the Bat, you know, the what Heath Ledger does in the second Batman movie, all right, or the guy from the third Batman, whatever. You know, what if there really are situations like that where it seems something extraordinary occasionally has to happen? What's the legal procedure for that? And I think it would be the way you could handle that would be analogous to cases of medical malpractice, right? So that you could have, I don't know what you would call it, but there could be insurance for the detectives and the police and so forth in case they commit a crime. So people have this in general, right? I mean, just the way I'm picturing it, probably everyone's got this basic policy just for you to be able to walk around town or whatever, go into malls, rent a car, have a job at most places. You probably have a basic insurance of this type saying, you know, if I get into a bar fight and kill somebody or whatever, pay me. But I'm saying you would need big policies if you were in a line of work where it was possible once in a blue moon, your job might require you to torture somebody during an interrogation. All right, so the way I think it would happen is I don't think the law itself would carve out this big exception for people in that case. I think the law would be the law, but there would be an acknowledgement that if you did it in the line of duty, like, so you're guilty. If it turned out that you tortured somebody, you know, so there's a bomb that's going to go off. You rounded up 100 suspects, and you know one of them probably planted the bomb, but you just don't know which one. And it's going to go off in a half an hour, and 2,000 fifth graders are going to die. All right? Nightmare scenario. What do you do? And you think with the pliers, you can get the information out of those people. Okay, so you start going through, you torture the first 54 guys, nothing. The 55th guy confesses, you go and defuse it. Okay, great. we saved all the fifth graders, but shoot, we just tortured 54 innocent guys. So now they go to their court, you know, they bring a lawsuit against you or your company, and but your company had insurance for just the sort of situation, and it had to pay premiums, and the insurance company charged premiums commensurate with the practices that this detective agency engages in. And if you get the point, all right? So there would have to be mechanisms in place so that it would make sense. So that somehow, I don't know how, you know, because I'm just making this example up on the fly, but in terms of cost and benefit, there's got to be a way that of saving those 1,000 fifth graders from getting blown up translates into revenue for that company, because they have to pay off those 54 people they just tortured, or the insurance company does, and then the insurance company needs to have charged premiums so that it can handle that, and so then how did the detective agency, how are they in a position to pay those high premiums? Well, it must be the case somehow that it makes sense to go ahead and do that kind of situation, all right? So again, I'm just making this particular example up on the fly, but I'm saying that's the way I think you should think it through, is that, yeah, in these crazy contrived cases where the critic is trying to say to you, oh, come on, in this case, there's some huge issue, you can't just ignore that. Well, okay, and that's what the whole point of trying to think about a free society and in the Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist tradition is you try to translate it into, all right, if there are these looming problems with the framework that we're throwing out there, what would a free society do? Okay, so in other words, suppose the detective agency couldn't do that. Maybe they didn't have insurance and they knew, you know, the boss pulled his agents aside and they're like, sir, give me the flyers, give me 45 minutes and I'll figure out where that bomb is. And he said, well, yeah, I'd like to let you do that, but there's 100 guys in there and 99 of them are innocent. We just couldn't afford to do that. Do you know how many lawsuits we're going to get if you go ahead and do that? And so and we don't have insurance for that. We have insurance for things like breaking somebody's arm during an arrest, stuff like that, or if your gun goes off and hits an innocent person, we have insurance for that, but we don't have insurance for torturing 54 or a bunch of people. He doesn't know what the number's going to be. So we just can't do it. And the bomb goes off and all the fifth graders die. And then the press investigates and the guy explains, we couldn't afford to do blah, blah. So now the community is going to see, oh, that kind of sucked. All those fifth graders died because the way our legal system was and the way our property rights worked and the way the detective agencies had their policies and procedures in place, in that the heat of the moment, that guy felt he couldn't go ahead and do what most of us in the community think he should have done. So what are we going to do? And entrepreneurs would brainstorm and, you know, some rival detective agency or maybe that same detective agency would say, okay, new policy, we've talked it over with our insurer, and now what we're going to say is, but they would have it too in their manuals, right? They would have it online, they would train their officers, because the community, you know, you're just saying, okay, don't worry, from now on, when we feel it's right, we're going to torture people, that's going to freak people out too. Okay, so that's the kind of thing I'm saying is, these issues of security and privacy and civil liberties and presumption of innocence, these are all valid things, and it's true. You can't just neatly put them on the little boxes and everything's hunky-dory. There really are situations in life where it's tough and it's not clear what the right thing to do is. So what I'm saying, though, is in a free society, they are going to discover solutions to those problems much better than just giving all the guns to one group of people and saying, okay, you guys solve it for us. All right, let's keep moving. As fun as torture is, let me torture you guys with some other thoughts. Okay, so that was just me handling defense against domestic problems. Now we're getting into the fun stuff. A free society based on private property, now how does it defend itself against foreign invasion? And it should go without saying, I have in mind here state-sponsored invasion, because I don't think two market anarchist or anarcho-capitalist or private property, voluntarist, whatever label you want to use, I don't think the two societies composed of those types of people and institutions would ever attack each other. It wouldn't be profitable. It wouldn't make any sense. There'd be nothing to gain from it. So what we're talking about here in the remainder of tonight's lecture is a market anarchist society, and then there's states out there that have big militaries with all of their tax funds and possibly conscripts, people that are subject to the military draft, and they might throw stuff at you. So what do we do? How do we deal with that? Okay, so as I spelled out in chaos theory, but I might as well cover here, here's where I really think insurance comes into play. And just let me emphasize on this issue, my view equals that of Rothbard and Hoppe. On the role of insurance. All right, now I apologize for making this so narcissistic. The point is, I don't care that you know, what does Murphy think, what does Rothbard, that's not the issue. The reason I'm stressing this is I want you guys to realize there are differences of opinion, just so you're aware of the different ways in which insurance might be involved in these things. So again, the difference with the way I approach private law is I thought within the society, day-to-day living, and there's people, and then some of them occasionally get out of line, or some of them occasionally are born without a conscience, and or some of them are just nuts, whatever, that what your insurance does is says, if I commit a crime, my insurance policy indemnifies the victim, and then maybe my insurance company comes after me. So the insurance policy I have to reassure my neighbors and other people in the community, and that greases the wheels and makes it easier for me to trade with them and interact with them in other ways. When it comes to defense against a foreign state setting in an armed invasion, there's no role for that kind of insurance. We don't need that kind of insurance to reassure the foreign invaders because they're coming in to attack us. It's not like we need to keep them happy. And they certainly don't need to take out insurance on themselves to reassure us. They don't want to reassure us. They're coming at us to take us over or to blow us up. Okay, so there's no point in having that type of insurance in this situation. So in this situation, when we're talking about a foreign military invasion, the role of insurance here is, in my view, is the same as what Rothbard and Hoppe talk about in general. So this is how they picture insurance operating both against a serial killer and against a foreign army. So the point is, just like if you have a lot of property, you might take out fire insurance because there's a small chance that there could be a fire, cause catastrophic damage, and so you as the owner, instead of gambling, as it were, and hoping you don't have the fire, instead what you do is you eliminate that risk of a catastrophic loss with the guaranteed but much smaller loss of paying a premium every month or whatever, every 6 months, for fire insurance. All right, so that's how that works. So it's the same thing here. If you own a skyscraper in Manhattan, just like there's a small chance of a fire that could be catastrophic, same token, there's a small chance that a foreign army might come and either blow it up or send troops and take it over so you effectively don't have it anymore. And so I think there'd be a role for insurance companies to offer policies protecting against that sort of event. Now, if that happens, what's interesting is now the insurance company is on the hook. And the crucial thing is the insurer can alter the risk of loss. right, so a lot more than with other types of insurance, when it comes to an insurance policy protecting the property owner against foreign invasion, with this type of policy, the insurance company is actually in a position to really change the actuarial probabilities. So, they take in premium payments, and then I think in a modern industrialized first world, whatever terminology you want to use, type of economy that was anarcho-capitalist, that it would be large insurance companies that would be the ones funding advanced military procurement. So if you are thinking that there has to be some market analog of the Department of Defense, and you're just trying to figure out what's the mechanism, what's the institutional framework by which we could take this general dispersed need for protection from foreign armies, and how actually do we get entrepreneurs to be able to profit from that? What's the mechanism? Like, just some guy goes on TV and says, hey, I'm going to build a bunch of tanks, and if you all donate $5 a month to me, I'll protect your house. And that seems kind of weird. I don't think that's how it would happen. I think it would be, like I say, everybody buys large insurance policies, or not everybody, but just the big property owners, at least, buy insurance policies, and then the premiums going to the insurance companies then make it in their interest to fund defensive operations so that they're pretty sure those events against which they've just insured don't ever happen or are very unlikely to happen. And again, this framework isn't science fiction. I mean, it's science fiction to apply it to military defense, but insurance companies do this kind of stuff all the time. If you have fire insurance, they'll cut you a break on your premiums if you put in smoke detectors and if you have extra extinguishers lying around, stuff like that. So the idea that the insurance company will think about ways to reduce the risk of the event happening, that happens in the real world all the time. That's not something anarcho-capitalist economists invented. Okay. What about the free rider problem? So let me just make sure you guys know what this is. Probably most of you do, but let's not assume anything. So here, this is the standard argument by an economist for government provision of defense. Right, so the idea is there would be a market failure if you just had military defense left to the free market, because I'll just say it loosely and quickly. Some foreign invader's coming, and so a company says, hey, who wants to pay for me to protect you from this guy? And so the first million people give him $1,000, and so now he's got $1 billion, and he builds a bunch of tanks and hires a bunch of troops, and they train for a while, and they set up a defensive perimeter, and then the foreign army pulls up and says, whoa, let's not invade these guys. That's going to be too painful. So they turn around, and then now what happened? Well, a million people paid, and then the other, whatever, 249 million didn't kick in a dime. And then next year, maybe the same event happens, and now did a million people still contribute? And they say, well, no, I paid last time. And on the margin, people realize whether I pay $1,000 or not isn't going to make the difference between us repelling the foreign invasion or not, so why would I pay? That's stupid. But then everybody thinks like that, and then we don't raise enough collectively to repel the invader, even though if everybody chipped in just $20, we could easily field an army and equip them and give them tanks and everything to repel the invader. But yet, because we can't actually compel everybody to kick in $20, but every individual donation is voluntary, just the way the incentives are and the type of problem it is, in equilibrium, you get way too little funding of military defense. Right? So that's the standard economic argument for why it makes sense that the government should be providing military defense as opposed to providing televisions or providing iPods. Okay, so again, I'm saying a generally free market economist who understands the problems of socialism and understands the problems of big government, blah, 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 but who isn't an anarchist, this would probably be what the guy would say. If you asked him, why couldn't the market just provide it? He'd probably give you an answer along those lines. So what's my response to that? Well, for one thing, I do think the approach of insurance at least pushes the problem back one step. So there, the issue is, you know, everyone's going to want to get an insurance policy to protect them, but then the issue is, if you hold out, so one insurance company could be charging and then using the premiums to buy tanks and whatever, and then once the risk goes down, some other insurance company can come in and they can charge people, and they can charge them lower premiums for the same level of coverage because they're not buying tanks. All they're doing is taking the money and going and buying real estate and bonds and stuff with it to build up financial assets to pay off in case. All right, and so since the general community has the same probability of being invaded, whether the people pay policies to the first insurance company or to the second one, the point is that in equilibrium, it wouldn't be profitable for an insurance company to exist and charge high enough premiums so that it could afford to then also pay soldiers and tanks and spy satellites and whatever. So that's the objection there. So it's people have conceded to me that, okay, yeah, what you're doing solves the free rider problem at the individual household level, but you're just pushing it back to the insurance companies. But there, I think that's good. That's progress because you've got this thing, and I apologize, I'm getting a little bit technical here, but this really is an issue where academic economists grapple, and I think they're wrong. And so I'm walking through the way I would actually deal with this if I were debating like Tyler Cowen or somebody on this issue. So because you have this thing called the Coase theorem, which many of you have probably heard of, and one of the implications of it is that with low transaction costs, you can get efficient outcomes because people just make side bargains and stuff like that. All right, so what I'm saying is it might be hard, step back a minute. We've got 250 million people. If we all just kicked in 20 bucks and we all could be sure everybody else were going to kick in 20 bucks, we'd be fine. We'd have plenty of money to defend, and we would all voluntarily agree to that. In other words, if some firm constructed a contract and what the contract said is, if you sign this, what you're pledging is that you're going to give $20 if 249 million and 500 other people sign the contract too. But if not, if you don't hit that critical number, you don't owe anything. So it's sort of like my Krugman debate thing. That, you know, you have to reach a tipping point or else you're not on the hook, right? So you can imagine constructing a contract like that and then going around and getting 249 million signatures, and then when it kicks in, boom, now everyone's bank account gets debited 20 bucks and that firm then can fund all the tanks and whatever. You can imagine that. And that outcome would be a Pareto improvement compared to the situation where there's just a market failure and nobody contributes anything because of the free rider problem, right? So that's something that a fan of the free market might say, like, we can overcome the free rider problem, the market failure objection, because you could come up with these sort of contingent contracts that are a little bit complicated. But that is kind of far-fetched to imagine some firm coming up with this contract that 100 million people need to sign before it kicks in. Right? That just seems a little bit weird. So what I'm saying is, if you concede that this insurance approach consolidates things, and so now instead of dealing with bilateral agreements among 250 million people, if now you're saying, oh, we could sort of collapse it so it's just like 10 major insurance companies now that are deciding on these issues, well, now it's a lot more plausible that they could all sit down. They're not stupid. They understand textbook economics, right? I mean, it's, remember, what we're talking about is these people, the viability of their society. So the idea that because of this little glib argument about the free rider problem, that their whole productive society is going to just crumble, and that these insurance executives that could have billions of dollars of revenue coming in are going to just throw up their hands and say, ah, foiled by the market failure, that's nuts. If they can come up with a contractual arrangement among each other to say, look, we understand there'd be incentives for us to undercut each other and to not fund for the tanks or whatever, but we know if we all start doing that, then this all falls apart and we get invaded. So let's not go down that road. You can imagine all sorts of ways they could contractually bind themselves so that that doesn't happen. And it's a lot easier to imagine 10 large companies doing that rather than 250 million individuals. So that's what I'm getting at here, that when you bring in the possibility of making side deals that are legally enforceable, a lot of these issues fall away, and then the only issue is, well, gee, are there a lot of transaction costs involved in doing that? And so if you can consolidate the problem through this insurance mechanism, well, then that's very useful. Okay, another point that I bring up in chaos theory, and I'll just reiterate it for you guys tonight, about this free rider problem is that actually I think in practice it's not as significant as people believe. So what they often have in mind is something like defense from an intercontinental ballistic missile. So they're imagining, oh my gosh, the Soviet Union back in the 1980s was going to fire 20 missiles at the United States that were armed with all sorts of hydrogen bombs, and basically entire cities were going to go under. And so the U.S. had to either come up with satellites that would knock them down or have its own silos that were hardened so that they couldn't get knocked out on a first strike and have the ability to retaliate so that the Soviets knew if they ever did that, they were going to die also, and so they wouldn't do it. And so then the point is, if that's your defensive strategy, mutually assured destruction, that you're saying we need to build enough nuclear weapons so that we can survive a first attack, first strike, and have enough remaining that we can obliterate whoever attacked us. Well, once you have that up and running, everybody's safe, right? It's not like you can restrict it and say we're only going to protect the people in this city who paid for it, and we're going to let the Soviet nuclear warhead come in and kill all the people who didn't pay. That's the issue, you know. But I'm saying that's really only in that kind of situation is one where military defense really is a true public good. In most actual applications, if you think it through, the people who are in charge of the military hardware actually can restrict it to shower most of its services on paying customers and to withhold protection from people who didn't pay. So the obvious example would be a convoy. So clearly, if the issue is you're at war with some nation and they're attacking your shipping, there's no issue of a free rider problem to say, how could the market provide naval escort services, to have submarines that would go out in advance and look around and make sure there's no mines or other submarines, and then to have battleships and aircraft carriers escorting the cargo ships across the ocean to wherever they're going. Clearly, you could say, all right, if the merchants don't want to pay for that, then we won't protect them, and they're going to be at the mercy of the foreign subs or whatever. Whereas if you do pay us, then we'll have our escort group go with you, and our subs will protect you from the enemy subs, and our fighters and whatever will protect you from the enemy fighters. So that's straightforward. So a Navy, in terms of protecting shipping, that's not even an issue. Clearly, a free market could handle that without even having insurance. I mean, that could just be a standard pay-for-service deal. And then even things like having tanks protecting property and having, so it's a little bit harder there, but even so, I think in practice it wouldn't be, how can I put it? So it wouldn't be crystal clear. It's true. It wouldn't be like saying if you have a restaurant, you're only going to give steak to the people who pay for it. I mean, obviously there you can control who gets the food or not. Whereas if you have a bunch of tanks and your job is to stop enemy tanks from blowing up buildings that your insurance company has agreed to insure, you might have to take out some enemy tanks, and that indirectly benefits the neighboring buildings that the owner didn't buy the insurance policy. That's true. But if we're talking about a huge city, then even if it's like every other house is insured, well, then still you're doing a 50% ratio, all right? And if there's like a neighborhood where just one house wants to sign up, maybe the insurance company says, nah, it's not worth it. We're not going to protect your, you know, we're not going to offer you a policy. You have to get 50% of your neighbors to sign up. Otherwise, we're not going to deploy a tank division to protect your neighborhood, right? So if the enemy troops have somehow landed and they've got their tanks roaming around harassing people and looting and pillaging and so forth, you're probably going to sign up with the insurance company pretty fast. So there's that element too. And maybe the rates, of course, are a lot higher in that scenario than if you had been paying all along. Right? So there's, like I say, stuff that you and I could think up just brainstorming over some beers. If this is real, if this is the real world, and there are actually people living in this free society, and there's guys on ships coming over with tanks, you don't think with millions of people in your population that they're not going to come up with some great ways to deal with that? I mean, it's just, anyway. Okay, calculation argument. So here's what I really want to drive home, the economics of it. That, and this is why I think a free market military defense or response would just blow a statist invasion out of the water if they were even in the same league. Right, so again, Nazi Germany is going to take over 1,000 anarchists, but is Nazi Germany going to take over 100,000 anarchists? No. And if Nazi Germany is invading the area that was known as Russia, do you want the Russians to be following Stalin and having him giving central orders? Or do you want to have a bunch of decentralized people doing what they think is in their own best interest and following property rights? You want the latter. Because if you're following orders from Stalin, you're just going to get slaughtered. And yeah, you're going to finally defend Stalingrad, but it's going to be extremely bloody, and you don't even want to think about the human casualties and how awful their standard of living is going to be during that siege. Whereas if all of Russia had been private, the Nazis wouldn't have even gotten to Stalingrad. They would have been blown up, you know, earlier. Okay. So the gist of the argument is just the calculation problem that Mises talked about, that you as a central planner, you have all sorts of resources at your disposal, and we're talking about specifically military applications. You've got snipers. You've got steel, you've got engineers, you've got a bunch of able-bodied men, and the issue is, what do you do with them? And it's it's not obvious the best way to effect military defense. There's a, you know, in chaos theory, I got into some specifics, but it's just not clear, right? Do you have more men working in the factory so you can crank out more tanks and more bullets and things like that, or do you have more of them in the field so you can have a bigger infantry division or whatever? Do you have them train longer, right? Because that's an issue too. So even once you make a big picture judgment and you say, okay, I'm going to have this many people go to the front lines, I'm going to have this many people become pilots, I'm going to have this many people learn how to operate submarines, I'm going to have this many people learn how to drive Jeeps, I'm going to have this many people become medics, because that's an issue too, right? You don't want to have zero medics, that's not efficient, but you don't want to have 90% medics, that's also not efficient. What's the right number? Who the heck knows? Certainly not Stalin. So even with all those issues, then there's just a thousand new questions. Okay, suppose for the sake of argument that you picked the right number to go into learning how to fly fighter jets. Well, how long do they train? And when you're designing the jets that they're going to fly, what do you do? Do you err on the side of having more jets that aren't as sophisticated? Do you err on the side of having the jets have more firepower but less protection for the pilot? Do you err on the side of them being able to carry more fuel and less, fewer warheads so that they can go farther, but then once they get to where they're going, they can't drop as much in terms of bombs because, you know, they needed more of the scarce space to have a bigger fuel tank, right? There's all these issues that are not simply, oh, let's go fight. Right, we're going to fight, and now the question is strategy and tactics. What's the most effective way to take the resources we have and to put up the best resistance? And again, it's when you start thinking it through like that, you realize it is an economic problem. Just like saying we want to feed the population, we have all these potential resources, how do we do it? Or we want to give medical care to people, or we want to teach people how to read and how to do mathematics and so forth. What's the best way to organize society to achieve that goal? And all those other applications, you realize that having freedom, private property, market solutions is more effective. And I'm saying it's the same thing if the objective is, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of foreigners coming in with guns and tanks and bombs, and they're trying to kill us and take us over. What do we do? Why would we think, oh, this is the one area where having a state monopoly and having a few guys who won a popularity contest last November, let's trust it to them. Why would that work? It doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, a few things here that let me point out that seem like liabilities to the average person of free market defense, but actually they're assets. All right, so these are things that would happen with a private property society where even the defense agencies have to abide by the law. They don't get a special pass just because, hey, there's a war on and we had to do what we had to do. No, this is good. And like I said, the critic would think this is handicapping the private property defense agencies, but actually you want them to be handicapped like this. This is a good thing. Okay, so one of them is that they would bear the cost of defensive activities. So, for example, let's say they decide they want to burn a bridge. Okay, so the way this would happen is the insurance companies running the numbers, and they realize, okay, we've got, there's a bunch of skyscrapers over here, so there's this island, and then there's a thing over here, and there's a bridge. And then there's all these enemy tanks rolling in. Yeah, you guys can see my former occupation was as an artist for Marvel Comics. Okay, so all these tanks are coming in, and the insurance company is trying to protect all these buildings over here. There's, you know, billions of dollars of skyscrapers here that are insured, and they've got all these troops over here who have all kinds of sophisticated anti-tank rockets and stuff like that. But, oh, my gosh, they're 6 hours away, and they're coming from up here. All right, because they were defending some other group of skyscrapers over here. So we're moving the forces over. You're the insurance company, and you've got billions of dollars of property right here that if that gets damaged, it's coming right off out of your bank account. And so you realize, okay, we need to stall these tanks. And you've only got like a few guys right here that are on your payroll. What do you do? So you tell them, okay, blow this bridge up. Just go plant some charges, blow that bridge up, because that will slow down these tanks, and that will buy time for then, you know, our anti-tank guys to show up, because we're moving them around, because we're, you know, we're a lean, mean, efficient organization. We don't have a standing army of a million people. We've got like 800 guys who are trained in anti-tank warfare, and they're the world's experts in that. With my 800 guys, I can stop 1,000 tanks if you give me 36 hours. But if I'm subject to, if I have five cities getting attacked simultaneously, well, I'm not going to spread the 800 guys out. I'm going to like do targeted, you know, boom, taking all the tanks in this city, boom, move over here, boom, boom, boom. And so, because, you know, cause that's the way they train, and maybe that's the way they're effective, is they work in unison. All right, so you could imagine a situation where it makes sense that the efficient outcome is to destroy some of your own property, right, to engage in friendly fire, if you will. So, and, you know, more things like you could plant mines, and you could do all kinds of booby traps and stuff like that. If the enemy were about to take over the airport and have access to all kinds of planes that then they were going to use to do surveillance runs, maybe you'd blow up the planes, right? So even though those are civilian aircraft that are owned by your neighbors, you as the insurance company and the defensive agencies trying to protect, you might find it in your interest to blow up your own property, right? And in military conflicts, that happens all the time, that kind of stuff. Okay, so what's my point? My point is that can still happen. That's fine. But you have to pay for it, right? If they're going to blow up this bridge, well, they have to pay the owner, because that's not their property. They can't do that. They just blew up the guy's bridge, and so he can take them to court and say, "Yeah, you blew up my bridge, so you owe me money," and they have to pay him. And so, like I say, a lot of people think, "Oh, that's handicapping. That's, you know, now they're fighting with one hand behind it. That's a good thing." That means now they're going to be very careful when they use resources. They're not going to willy-nilly blow stuff up. You don't want them blowing up something unless it's worth it. And so that's what I'm saying. So they have a mechanism. If there is a situation where it really does make sense for them to destroy property, they can go ahead and do that. And they that's what they've been charging those premiums for. They have a bunch of money. They're going to use some of the premiums to hire snipers, to hire anti-tank personnel, and they're going to have some money that in case they have to blow up property to compensate the owners. So this is a good thing. It protects, obviously, the guy who owns the bridge, right? If it were a status thing and the bridge just got blown up and the government said, well, hey, we were being invaded, we had to do it, sorry, take one for the team. Well, now that guy just unfairly had to bear a huge part of the total community's burden of repelling those invaders, whereas under this scenario, it's much more efficiently allocated, and it's all voluntary. Okay, similar idea with conscription. For some reason, people think that the state that's invading us has this huge advantage because they can have a bunch of military conscripts. But no, that's, again, it's the calculation argument. Change the analogy for a minute. Change the scenario. If we said, "Oh, I really wish," we want to have better computers than the Chinese make. What should we do? If someone said, "Oh, I know, let's have the federal government force people at gunpoint to go into software engineering, and we'll just have millions of people go in and do that, and they'll get trained in terms of programming and this and that." And then we'll just have all these massive efforts, and we'll spend hundreds of billions of dollars to crank out computer code and to come up with better generations of computer software. Do we really think that that would be the way to really produce high quality software? I don't think it is. I think instead what you would say is, all right, if you want our country to be the world leader in software design, get rid of capital gains taxes, get rid of payroll taxes, get rid of the government funding of education, get rid of all this other stuff, and then wait and see the geniuses that this free society will produce, and look at all these Silicon Valley companies, the stuff they'll come up with if you free them up and just take the shackles off. That's the way you would produce high quality software, not just brute force, let's have the government just manhandle everything and try to force it. So the same thing here. I mean, when I see pictures like this, when I see, you see this in movies, that lately, like within the last 5 years, it's like every big blockbuster ends up with having these huge armies running at each other. And then they meet in the middle of the screen and people just get slaughtered. As an economist, that offends me. What a waste of labor. That's disgusting. I mean, the human mind is one of the most valuable resources on the planet. And the best way you can use hundreds of thousands of guys on your side is to just have them march into a bunch of bayonets and cannons. That's crazy. That can't possibly be an efficient use of resources. And yet that's what happens under conscription. Right? So by no means is it an advantage for you to be able to have your government force all of your able-bodied men to line up in single file and to drill and sing songs and then go marching into the same configuration on the other side. That's crazy. You could do a lot more damage to the other side military with one-tenth the manpower if they were organized voluntarily as mercenaries. All right, so that's what I'm getting at. We're low on time here, so I don't want to dwell too much on it, but there's a great discussion of this in Jeff Hummel's book. It's, what's it called? I think it's called, Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men. All right, so that's a great book. He's talking about the war between the states, or the what's often called the American Civil War. And one of his great points in this is he said that a bunch of the strategists in Europe, when the conflict was brewing and they could tell war was going to break out, they just thought it was an open and shut case that, of course, the South, the Confederacy, would fend off the Union invasions. I mean, the Confederacy wasn't going to be able to conquer the North, but they weren't trying to. They just wanted to secede and be their own country, just like the 13 colonies seceded from Great Britain. It wasn't that the Americans took over the British Empire. They couldn't have done that. No, what they did, though, is they made it not worth the effort that it would have taken to maintain an occupying force in the United States. So the British finally said, okay, forget you guys, and they left. And so that's what that's what the political strategists and military theorists, that's what they thought was going to happen with the American Civil War in the beginning, because in such a big area, there were so many people in the Confederacy, they had just engaged in guerrilla warfare and just, you know, hung out in the trees and took pot shots at Union troops. I mean, how could you possibly have policed that? They wouldn't have been. But what did the South do? They tried to fight it the way a government fights wars. And so the South's own government at gunpoint basically rounded up all the able-bodied men and said, okay, you're all going to get in line here. You're all going to put on uniforms so we can make sure you don't run away. We'll be able to find you if you do. And you see those Union troops that are coming, and they're better armed than you are, and they have more cannons. Let's just march right into them. But we're going to play some drums and get you all fired up, and this is going to be the bloodiest war in human history possibly. Crazy. All right, so you couldn't, I mean, the Southern government, the Confederate government, could not have come up with a better way to hurt its own cause than by engaging in conscription and literally marching its troops into the Union guns. Think about that. I mean, unless they ordered their men to kill themselves. So this idea that conscription somehow gives your side an advantage is nutty. Okay, let me just zip through these legal issues. Again, not going to have time for Q&A. I will answer all this stuff that you're posting. I don't do this intentionally, but I start talking about Civil War, I get all fired up. Okay, legal issues. Let me just jump into some of these. Okay, so assassination. So this is an interesting one. A lot of people say that there wouldn't be this widespread warfare, and that if an anarcho-capitalist society for some reason ever found itself at war with a foreign state, that they wouldn't field a bunch of tanks and whatever and have these huge battles. They would just send in a sniper team and take out the enemy head of state. And that's what they would do. Boom, the war, you know, they'd put a bounty on the guy's head. And they wouldn't even necessarily need to have their own people do it. They could just post a thing saying, we'll give $10 million or we'll give whatever, 10,000 gold ounces to anybody who can prove to us that you were the one who killed the head of the Chinese Communist Party or whatever, if the Chinese are trying to invade us. And then, so that's it. So if you're this real wealthy society, you wouldn't even need to field a big army, whatever. You could just pay for that kind of thing. So I think that's something definitely you want to consider. Now, so the issue is, what would be the legality of that, though? So I'm not worried right now about the military tactics and strategy, and is that a smart move, or would that just inflame the other side against you and bring on more retaliation? We're putting those issues. I'm just saying, legally speaking, given our notion of a private law society and so on, what would be the legal standing of that government? Here are my general thoughts on that sort of issue. The way I'm picturing it, it would be hard to do that preemptively. But I think clearly once that foreign power started attacking your stuff, you could do it. And so here's how it would happen, I believe, or this is one way it could happen. Okay, so you got, again, let's assume it's the Chinese. They come over, because the U.S. right now is all anarcho-capitalist. They come over, they want to soften up the defenses, right, before they land their infantry. So they have bombers and stuff doing sorties, and they're just carpet bombing Manhattan and anywhere that they think that there's going to be a defense mounted. So they're racking up thousands of or millions of dollars worth of property damage, maybe billions. So the property owners then, they have claims against this organization. You can call it what you will, the Chinese military or whatever. Just like if some other company, if its employees come on my property and start breaking stuff, I as the business owner can bring suit against that company. Maybe I bring it against the individuals too, but if they're operating, the legal procedures probably allow me to sue the employer if he's literally ordering his employees to break my stuff. So there's all court, and then they go to court, and the judge says to the Chinese communist officials, okay, there's a pending legal challenge here in our courts. Do you want to defend yourself? They probably say, go jump in the lake. Okay, the private judges in our little free society all rule, they rule, yep, those bombers are guilty. They had no reason for dropping bombs on your skyscraper. Okay, so we rule in favor of the plaintiff. The Chinese military organization owes $3.6 billion in compensation. And then, oh my gosh, the Chinese communists aren't paying that. Huh, I'm so surprised. Because they don't care. They laugh at this pending legal agreement, this little society they're trying to steamroller over. Okay, so now legally within the free society, I think then the insurance companies might go to those property owners, even if those property owners were insured or not. Let's say they weren't insured. If they were insured, then it's easy. It's all like within the same company. But let's say they weren't. So now you're this property owner, and your building just got half of it blown off by this bomb from this Chinese bomber, and you've got this court ruling that says the Chinese military owes you $300,000, but you have no hope that they're ever going to pay you. So now I think the insurance company approaches me and says, hey, you know what? We both know they're not going to pay you. We, however, have a plan to go take it to them. And so, but we need to be able to have offsetting claims, because what we're going to do is going to involve some property damage, even though some innocent people over in China. So what we want to do is we'll buy your claim off you for 10 cents on the dollar. So right now, our court system acknowledges the Chinese military owes you $300,000 in damages. We'll give you $30,000 for you to transfer to us that claim against the Chinese military. And he goes, oh, okay. And so they do that, and then they go around to all the people, and they collect that stuff up. So now this insurance company, or this team of insurance companies, has, let's say, $3 billion worth of claims against the Chinese military. So now they can go and do all kinds of up to $3 billion worth of damage. So they can go attack people that weren't even involved in the bombing. You know what I'm saying? Like, they can go attack the guys guarding the communist officials if they need to. Like, if they're going to send a team in that's going to take out the guards and then go in and blow up the door protecting him or whatever and get in there. And then, you know, so my point is I don't think there should be this just blanket exemption and say, oh, if we're at war, all of our laws don't apply, you can go kill foreign civilians. That doesn't make sense to me. I think you have to have the same legal framework, and what would happen is if you go and kill the head of the foreign state or whatever, and then his next of kin brings charges in the anarchist courts, the judge might say, yeah, that's right. It's not clear what happened there. But the point is they would have all these claims that they had accumulated for pennies on the dollar to offset that. So that's the kind of way I'm picturing this stuff happening. So, again, it would be contained, but if it really did make sense, they might launch some foreign operation to do that. Okay, last thing, and then we got to stop, is what about weapons of mass destruction? So here, first of all, the main thing, I think, is I don't actually believe there'd be a lot of states that would want to attack an anarcho-capitalist society, because it would not pose a threat to them, right? Just like the Nazis didn't invade Switzerland. And it was a combination of things that it would have been difficult, but also they realized the Swiss aren't going to bother us. All right, so I think it's the same thing here. If you're this hostile state intent on world domination, the last pocket of resistance you even need to worry about is the anarcho-capitalist group. If you don't mess with them, they're not going to mess with you. So you can try to take over all the other states first, and then maybe once you've taken over the rest of the world, you might then focus on, okay, and now we're going to wipe you guys out. All right, so I think just in everyday life, with a bunch of different states and some pockets of anarcho-capitalism and some pockets of statism, the anarcho-capitalists, I don't think, would have a big bullseye on them. What would be the point? And also because, remember, especially rogue states would love dealing with them, because there'd be all sorts of contraband and things produced in the anarcho-capitalist region, like, you know, drugs and guns and stuff like that flowing to all sorts of places where groups like the U.S. and Great Britain were trying to clamp down on. All right, so the anarcho-capitalist region would be very friendly with all these other countries, right? They certainly wouldn't be afraid. So the one thing that you could imagine is that the so-called free world, like the U.S. and Great Britain and countries like that, might perceive the existence of this anarcho-capitalist society as a standing insult to what they preach to their people, right? It would sort of be embarrassing if there's this group out there that clearly has better educated children, higher standard of living, blah, 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 you know, lower incidence of poverty and malnutrition and all this other stuff, and they have no taxes. that would be awkward. So there, I think they would perceive it as a threat ideologically. And again, I don't picture it coming from Iran or China or North Korea. I think if there were an anarcho-capitalist society that were viable and was growing, the people that would take it out would be the United States and Great Britain and things like that. That it would be, it would ruin their propaganda. So how would they, you know, what's going to happen? Well, fortunately, it would be kind of difficult for the U.S. to simply go drop a nuclear bomb and kill 200,000 anarchists and just say, oh, well, because they're a threat. You see what I'm saying? That by its very nature, the anarcho-capitalist society would be have all defensive weapons. They wouldn't have long-range stuff. And even if the U.S. government tried to frame them and, like, you know, make it look like, or maybe there really would happen, maybe there would be terrorists in the anarcho-capitalist community that would go over and try to attack U.S. politicians or something, I think it would be difficult for the U.S. to justify to Americans, we have to go drop nuclear bombs on these people. You know, they might blockade, if it's on like a little island or something, they could blockade them with the U.S. Navy and try to starve them and that sort of thing. But I think it would be difficult to launch an all-out nuclear strike, and that's the kind of thing it would take, right? Because the anarcho-capitalist society clearly would have satellite defenses, surface-to-air missiles, things like that, that you couldn't just send one or two missiles in. You would really have to just launch full-scale, we're going to blow these people up in order to overwhelm their defenses. All right, so that's the way I'm picturing it. And last point, I know we're over time here, I apologize. Last point on that is, right now, there are plenty of governments around the world that do not have nuclear technology, that don't have nuclear weapons. All right, so I think it's partly, if you are American like I am, and you grew up in a world thinking, oh my gosh, you need to have a nuclear bomb or else you're going to get invaded every 2 seconds. No, that's not true. There's a balance of power, and some places, some governments have nuclear weapons and some don't. And when you ask yourself, how is it that the ones that don't have managed to not be invaded so far, and you list the reasons for why you think that's the case, those reasons would apply all the more so to an anarcho-capitalist society, except, like I said, for the one glaring exception that their very existence would be an ideological challenge to the so-called free world governments, and so they might need to wipe it out for that reason. But in terms of posing an actual threat to anybody, the anarcho-capitalist society would be the most harmless neighbor imaginable. In fact, they'd be the greatest ally. Their existence would enrich everybody. I mean, there would be, last point, and then I'll stop. Think of it this way. Like, China would love to have some anarcho-capitalist thing because they could send all of their political prisoners there, right? So if you had a bunch of convicts that you just wanted to get rid of them, and you're some statist dictator, what better thing than just send them to that place? Because I think they'd welcome with open arms. You know, they'd have all sorts of institutions in place to absorb those people. You know, insurance companies would come in and rate them and say, what'd you do? And if you were saying, well, I raped a bunch of people, and I robbed a few banks over there in Iran, and he was going to cut my head off, but then he decided just to dish me off on you guys, they could say, okay, well, you're going to have to stay in these, you know, these facilities we have where you can't leave, but if you have some skill, they say, oh, yeah, actually, I know how to program computers. All right, well, come on in. All right, so you get what I'm saying, that human beings are very productive, and the anarcho-capitalist society would figure out how to use them. And so governments around the world, instead of housing prisoners, one thing they could do would be just literally to sell them to the anarcho-capitalists. And so they said, why are we paying to feed these people when we can literally sell them? And it wouldn't be slavery, but I'm saying from the statist government's point of view, to them it would be like getting paid for shipping their people over. So it's not that they would be owned by, but like the groups, the prisons would realize, wait a minute, there's a profit margin there. So, yeah, I will pay money to the foreign state government to ship people over here, and then they dump them on the ocean or on the property, you know, the harbor, and then they're sitting there, uh-oh, yeah, I just got kicked off the prison ship from China, here I am, or from wherever, Iran, here I am, and then now the prison official approaches them and says, hey, do you want to come live in our place? And then there's another guy coming up and dickering and saying, no, come live at our place. We'll pay you more, and we have better cable. Okay, so that's the way I'm picturing. So the existence of the anarcho-capitalist society would benefit all kinds of other governments, even in practical terms. Okay, got to stop there. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I will address your questions soon.